So I thought to speak on a very universal, broad topic, continuing from a discussion that took place, a series of talks that when I was visiting in St. Louis, they asked me to cover sections from Srimad Bhagavatam's sixth canto on prescribed duties of mankind. Because that's the title of the chapter, or title, excuse me, of the canto. And the canto title fits in with the whole message of the entire Bhagavatam very nicely. Because the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is speaking about para dharma. Savai pungsang paro dharmo yato bhaktir adhoksaje. What's the rest? Ahaitaki? I'm just giving him an exam. I know the verse. I was just seeing if he knows the verse. He got paralyzed. So you helped him. Or Satyam Param Dhimahi, in the first verse of the Bhagavatam. Dharma Prodita Kaitavotra Paramo Nirmatsaranam Satam. The message of the Srimad Bhagavatam is about para dharma. And what's para dharma? Para dharma is the para dharma. It's the supreme occupation of all living beings. Because dharma, traditionally, that's translated as duty or religiosity. In the Bhagavad Gita, the 18th chapter, astikyam is the term that's used to indicate religiosity. So dharma isn't really religiosity. Whoa. Samadhamaktapakshocham shantir arjavam evacha jnanam vijnanam astikyam. Brahma karma swabhava jam. That's another nice term, swabhava. There's material and there's spiritual swabhava. There's material and there's spiritual dharma. How's that for a starting point? Swabhava, bhava means nature, and sva means one's own nature. Svabhava. So if your svabhava is the mode of goodness, then you do brahma karma. Svabhava jam. Ja means takes birth. From the quality of goodness, there's this, from the svabhava of being in contact with the mode of goodness, then there are different brahminical activities, brahma karma. And so then you've described, or Krishna describes, those brahma karmas. Sama, dhamma, tapa, socham, kshantir, arjavam, evacha, jnanam, vijnanamastikyam. Those are behaviors, brahma karma behaviors, that arise from material swabhava. So those are his duties. And so religiosity is on the material side. But there's a spiritual swabhava. What's that? It's not born of contact with the modes of nature, because material swabhavas are. mode of goodness, the mode of passion, the mix of ignorance and passion and ignorance. Vaishya karma swabhavajam, shudra karma swabhavajam, kshatriya karma swabhavajam. But then there's, when there's no contact with the modes of nature, what's that? It's your, the soul's swabhava. And the soul has a svarup, a spiritual form. We also have a bodily form, but there's a spiritual form. There's material form and there's spiritual form. There's material svabhava and there's spiritual svabhava. There's material dharma, religiosity, and there's transcendental. What is spiritual? Commonly in just the way that people speak these days, common vernacular, someone is called spiritual if they're situated more in the mode of goodness than everybody else. A spiritual person, because they do selfless things. They're not selfish. They're not greedy and selfish and lusty, and they control their anger. And those are things that should be the characteristics of a Brahmin. But the Brahmin is in contact with the mode of goodness, and those traits are born from that swabhava, that contact with sattva-guna. So they do sattva-guna activities or brahminical activities. But the transcendentalists that aren't in contact at all with any of the modes of material nature. Nishtraigunya Bhavarjuna. Second chapter, Krishna advises Arjuna, rise above the three modes of material nature, be transcendental to all of them. And not only what you do, but the goal of doing the things that you do. Not just a behavior. It's a consciousness behind the behavior. Transcendental consciousness. That's the subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's Paradharma. So to distinguish Paradharma from the other kind, Vyasadeva chooses to use the word, or the adjective, Kaitava, Dharma. And Kaitava is a strong word. Kaitava means cheating. And Dharmic people don't cheat. But there's kind of a dharma where it cheats the soul or steals from the soul the potential in this human form of life, the potential of awakening the fullness of God consciousness. It takes it away to do the other kind. You take something else as the goal, or something else as the goal, or something else as the goal. Commonly, it's attaining Svargaloka. And in this life, accumulating piety so that in this life you can prosper, enjoy nicely, religiously, but enjoy, and in the next life, enjoy even more. Commonly, not just in one part of the world or another, or one culture of the world or another. Commonly, that's what people think religion, the purpose of religion is. Religion is that so that you can get, and they even give it a nice name. They call it salvation. That's what the Christians call it, salvation. The Vedic term for salvation would be moksha. But moksha means no more birth and death. Punarjanma na vidyate. But you go to heaven, it's very clearly expressed in Bhagavad Gita, kshine punya marcha lokam vishanti. One has to, it's like the Ferris wheel. Boop, 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 boop. Boop, 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 boop. You have to come back again to this bhu-mandala, this earthly region, planetary region, take birth, and then boop, 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 do more piety. do that kind of dharma so that you can stay in the heavenly region for some time and boop, 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 after some time you come back. And you can go on endlessly, just like riding a big Ferris wheel. Just set it down. Thanks. So paradharma has another purpose altogether. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, purnarjanma navidyate. No more Ferris wheel. But chakvadeham punar janma na mamiti. You no more birth and death, ending the wheel of samsara by becoming fixed in thought of Krishna. So that's the message of the Bhagavatam, and one of the cantos of the Bhagavatam focuses on that message, and that's the sixth canto. And so the heading of the canto is Prescribed Duties for Mankind. Now, just one comment. There aren't prescribed duties for the forms of life below the human form of life. We don't expect to hold the program, invite all the dogs in the neighborhood so they can come and take part, or giraffes or elephants or squirrels or monkeys or birds. Or it's the human form of life has the capacity. So those that have less capacity, they don't have laws, even in society, what to speak of the spiritual picture or the scriptural picture. Prabhupada gives this example. There's a law that says keep to the right. And what happens if you don't keep to the right? You drive your car on the other side. Pull over, buddy. Let me see your driver license and registration. Don't you read the sign? You just keep to the right. What are you doing? I'm going to give you a summons. You're under arrest. Breaking law. So, but if there's a horse, or, you know, bigger than a horse, an elephant or a dog or, you know, some other than a human being, and they're on the left-hand side, there's no penalty. They're not breaking the law, because the law is for the human society. That's in the material side. And then the scriptural side is also, the prescribed duties are for mankind, because the capacity is there with elevated consciousness to then use it properly to achieve the purpose of human life. The purpose of human life is not material elevation in this or the next life. The purpose of human life is not that. It's to understand Krishna. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. The purpose of the Vedas is to understand Him, and through the assistance of the Vedas, one can understand Him. Without religion and principles of religion, where this is a theme that Prabhupada would speak on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, where the same as an animal. The animal's unregulated, and if we are also unregulated, we're same as an animal. If we do the same things that animals do in a more sophisticated way, we're eating at a table off of plates, and they're eating on the floor out of a bowl. What's the difference? The activity is the same, and advancement is you sit at a table instead of on the floor in a bowl. So what if we sit on the floor and eat out of a bowl? Are we like an animal? We're following religious principle. We're taking the remnants of... Anyway, the animals are doing the same things that people are doing. People are doing the same thing that animals are doing, in short, without the whole comparison. So what's the distinction? The distinction is dharma, religious principle. And then what is paradharma? What is that can carry you to the other side of material existence. That's Paradharma. So I'm not going to recreate, that's the topic. And there's sections in the sixth canto that explain it. And it's basically principles are laid out, and then it's illustrating the principles. Principles of Karmakanda, and the story of Daksha is told. It's different Daksha than the Daksha that's in the fourth canto that offended Lord Shiva. And as a result, he lost his head, literally. Virabhadra came and chopped his head off. And everyone, that was really awful. So the Ashwini Kumaras gave him another head, a goat's head instead. So here's this beautiful, used to be beautiful Daksha walking around with a goat's head. So that's a different Daksha. This is, he died. He died of shame because before he was so beautiful. And so expert, that's what his name means, Daksha. He was expert in fruitive activities, but he was proud. So he, with that pride, he offended Shiva, and with that he lost his head, and with that he died of embarrassment. Prabhupada told the story once of how attached materialistic people can be. A person, when he was a householder, had a court case lodged against him for something, someone that Prabhupada knew from the course of his business. And the judgment that was made was against him, and he lost everything. And the man died in 1 year because Prabhupada knew the man. He said he lost his will to live because not just the embarrassment, but all those things that he had, and if he doesn't have those things, and what's the use living? His will to live evaporated. And he died in a year. Doesn't say how long it took Daksha to die, but he died. And then he took birth again. And that's described in the... So, Daksha, although in his previous life, this is something about those that are very, very expert in Karmakanda rituals. He was very expert. Although he made an apology to Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva forgave him, so that reaction was taken away after he had the goat's head. But the tendency to do the same thing continued in his next life. So that when he had opportunity to associate with Narada Muni, before it was Lord Shiva, now it's Narada Muni, and he offended him so badly because basically he was envious and he didn't understand Narada Muni. He thought something else Narada Muni, and so he spoke very harshly, viciously, cruelly, offensively against Narada Muni. But Narada Muni deliberately did all the things that he did so that he could deliver Daksha from his insane over-attachment to fruitive activities. Because he was able to do that and had the strength to do that because he was fixed in Paradharma. He was fixed in his spiritual identity, literally fixed in his spiritual identity. So there wasn't anything material that could shake him or go up or down. So in the course of the sixth canto, examples of Jnanakanda and Karmakanda are placed in comparison or contrast with Paradharma so that one can clearly understand. So I wanted to just speak on one verse that summarizes that essence of the essence of the whole canto. It's spoken by Shukadeva Goswami, and it's spoken in response to a question by Maharaj Parikshit. The question is, what can be done to relieve people who have performed sinful activities from having to experience the reaction of those sinful activities, which is experiencing the hellish regions? Because in the fifth canto, the whole Vedic cosmology is presented. It's fascinating. If you like technical things, there's a nice section for you. It has all kinds of numbers and, you know, time durations and, you know, the size of the universe, the diameter of the universe, the size of the planets and their period of their rotation. It's very empirically precise. But in addition to describing those numerical things, he describes, as all religions describe in some form or fashion, heaven and hell and the place where we are, someplace in between. And after describing the hellish planets, then Maharaj Parikshit has this question. That was awful. Hearing this description of the hellish planets, what can be done to prevent people from having to experience? So that's a theological question that makes the answer to which makes up different religions. Some religions say this, and that's their religion. Some religions say that, that's the religion. Some religions say other things, and then you have another religion. So the basis, how Shukadeva Goswami responds is not, you know, pick this religion or pick that religion. He speaks of principles. You follow? Let me just say it again, because this is important, so let's see if it sinks in, if it didn't. The Bhagavatam is not an ism. It's not a belief system. Prabhupada has used that dictionary definition. You look it up in the dictionary, and religion, one of the definitions you'll find is, for religion it says, a kind of belief in God. So there's this religion and that religion, so you have this kind of belief or you have that kind of belief, and so you have different religions. But the Sanskrit word dharma is not this belief, that belief. Dharma literally means, that the root means, that which sustains. So, an example, the dharma of sugar, is it sweet? The dharma of fire is heat and light. You don't find fire without heat and light. You don't find fire, or you don't find heat without fire, you don't find light without fire. So here's some light. The top of this pole here, there's some light. I see the light. Now, there's not a fire inside this bowl, but there's light, and the light comes from fire. So here's how Prabhupada explains. The sunlight shines. That's fire. And by various means, it can be a solar thing on the roof, or somewhere that's exposed to the sun, and it can somehow store electricity, because that's what electricity is, it's just fire. Or by photosynthetic process, a tree or plant gathers the light of the sun and stores it, and then you use that as fuel, or maybe it sits around for a long time and becomes petroleum. And then you burn it, and it can produce electricity. electro generators, and then you get, with electricity, you get light. So it's just, the Vedic concept is that's just transformation of fire. And where, so wherever there's light, or there's heat, there's fire. In our Chicago temple, it's a very old building, 1920s or something like that, not that old, but the wiring in the wall is old. But it's not like this. This is, you know, sheetrock. You can cut some sheetrock and put it, you know, go inside and fix something, put the sheetrock over, plaster it up. It looks great. You don't even know you broke the wall. But the wall in the Chicago temple, it's different. It's strips of wood and layers of plaster, and then strips of wood going the other way and layers of plaster. And so it's very difficult. There's a place where I stay that if I plug too many things in the wall starts to get hot. Because the wire can't hold all that electricity because it's old wire. And, you know, that's dangerous because there's the lath and plaster, and behind that there's, you know, getting hotter and hotter. It can burn the temple down. At least burn a nice hole in the wall. So you got a little power strip that has a little, you know, circuit breaker thing. And, you know, if you have too much electricity, that, you don't start a fire, it just pops. But the point is, behind the heat in the wall, there's fire. It may not be blazing fire, but there's fire. Just like, here's a table underneath this. And the table is wood, made of wood. And within the wood, there's fire. The chair that you're sitting on is wood. And within the wood, there's fire. But it's stored, don't worry. Because the leaves of the tree took the fire from the sun and stored it in the wood. But, you know, from the Vedic model, earth, water, fire, air, ether, the fire is there. And proof, you take another fire, little match, and hold it to the wood, and it gets hot and hotter, and then fire comes out. It's stored. Or a match. It's fire, little firebox. But it's stored until you strike it, and then fire comes out. The principle, yeah. Dharma is the constitutional position of the soul. It says there's the constitutional position of fire as heat and light. The constitutional position of water is its liquidity. You can make it cold and it becomes ice. You can make it hot, it becomes vapor. But if it's water, it's liquid. That's in its natural state. Water means liquid. It's liquidity. So wherever there's something that's liquid, you know that there's some water. You follow. So the constitutional position of, or the dharma of the living entity is service. You can take away all the other differences of living entities, just like fire. I learned this in chemistry, you know, different elements, they burn in different colors. Some red, some blue, some green. You can tell what it is because you put it in a Bunsen burner and it burns green. Oh, well, so that means it's such and such. But it's fire, whether it's green or blue or polka dots. It's fire. So what is it? Take away all the differences of the living entity. And what's the essence? What is that which sustains the living entity? Its universal presence is service. So Sanatana Dharma is that the constitutional, the eternal essence of the living being, and that Sanatana Dharma, eternal essence of living being, is service to God. If we're not service to God, we're serving something. And is there anybody that can say, I'm not serving anybody? Supposing, you know, a big man, a corporate person. He's paying his taxes. If he doesn't, he's in jail. Or, you know, the president. You know, he's serving the electorate, the people that voted him. If he doesn't do it, they yank him out. Throw him away and get another one. And then maybe somebody's a tyrant and he thinks, you know, I'm Stalin. Anybody gets in the way, I mow him down. You know, death comes and takes him away. Out, exit stage left, there goes Stalin. We're all subordinate and serving. Serving the senses, serving a dog, serving our mind, serving something. Serving our family, serving our boss, serving our country. And all those things that I just named, they're just expansions of God's energy. We're actually ultimately serving God. Not very nicely, but to do it nicely, that's paradharma. Supreme occupation of the living being. So, to answer Shukadeva Goswami's answer to Maharaj Pariksit's question, what can be done to help a living entity become free from the reactions of their misdeeds? There's a material answer, or there's a material answer, or there's a spiritual answer. Guess which one the Bhagavatam prefers. The material answer is, within the karmakanda process, there is a means of neutralizing reactions, prayaschitta, or atonement. Prabhupada's example is, even in the worldly experience, there is such an example. Supposing somebody was driving on the left side of the road. Pull over, buddy. Let me see your license and registration. Okay, you got to pay a fine. That's the prayaschitta. Some atonement. You broke the rule. There's a law and you broke the law. There's laws of God, and if you violate the laws of God, that's sin. Yes? Papa. You violate the laws of God, it's sin. And there's a means of atoning for sin, prayaschitta. When that's presented by Shukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Pariksit says, well, wait a minute. I had experience as the king when people would break the law or violate the laws of Manu and they would be punished by the government. After that punishment, put in prison for some time or whatever, set them free and they go back out and do it again. Because the tendency wasn't taken away. But atonement doesn't take away tendency to sin. So what can be done to check that? So that the karmakanda notion is dismissed or put in a, it's okay, it does something, but it's not complete. So then jnanakanda, Shukadeva Goswami says, very good, you're right. One needs knowledge, because when you have knowledge, there's a chance that you won't do the things that are wrong. You'll do the things that are right. You won't do the things that are wrong. But that's not sufficient either, because even if one has knowledge, one can act incorrectly. So jnanakanda and karmakanda are both incomplete. They're parts of the Vedic literature, so they're not zero. But it's not complete. So now comes the one verse that I wanted to speak about. Shukadeva Goswami says, Kichit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayana agham. Agham means sins. Agham dhunvanti karchnyaya. Niharam Iva Bhaskaram. He uses a metaphor, Iva, like this, so that, like the Bhaskar, the direct light of the sun, when it shines on a and fog or mist. Niharam means fog. So those of you from North India, you know all about this, because it's in the winter time. During the day it's warm, so the air is warm and the ground is warm and it's comfortable, but at night it's very cold. So the air is very, very cold, but the land stays more warm than the air. And so in the early morning, there's fog. Yes? Any North Indians? So, yes. You know what I'm talking about. January, February, late December. The Delhi airport's a madhouse in the early morning class because they won't let planes take off in the fog, and it's always fog. And they schedule all the flights at the same time because everybody wants to get to Bangalore or to wherever they're going to, you know, do their business and get back, and they can be late for their appointment because the planes won't take off. But when the rays of the sun come finally and directly shine on the fog, at once the whole big thing of blanket of fog is gone. Amazing. And that's the metaphor that's used. So like that, kichit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayana. So kevala bhakti. Kevala is another strong word. Kevala means absolute. Nothing else but. No mixture of karma and gyan. Exclusive devotion. Avyavachari bhakti is another term that means the same thing. Unmixed devotion. Absolute devotion. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva. Unto Krishna, Parayana. The translation of Parayana is completely attached. Then Prabhupada puts in parentheses, only to such service without dependence on austerity, penance, cultivation of knowledge, or pious activities. One may be pious, or one may be austere, or one may have cultivated knowledge, or one may have some fruits of well-being in your treasury, in your stockpile, in your merit, your punya, or sukriti. But that's not what you rely on. You rely on paradharma, or kevala bhakti. It relies exclusively on Krishna. The consciousness of depending fully upon Krishna and trying exclusively to please and to honor Krishna, to serve Krishna. So let's say, supposing you're a parent. And you're very concerned to train your children nicely. So you want them to learn proper social manners and good behavior. So you teach them what all parents teach their children. Things like saying please and thank you. Because, you know, children don't know social behavior. They're like animals. If they want something, they grab something. So that the mother holds their hand and says, what do you say? It's universal. And the child knows the prompt and they say, please. And then she says, okay. And then they grab it. And then Then the mother says, and what do you say? Thank you. Right? So that's a behavior. It's important that there's good manners and proper behavior. But far more important behind the behavior is the consciousness behind the behavior. And that's what's this Vasudeva Parayana, completely dependent upon pleasing Krishna. Say please and thank you, but depend upon pleasing Krishna as your motivation. And for anything that you do and everything that you do, in your everyday exchanges in the home or in the workplace or in the marketplace or in the wherever you go, that Krishna should be pleased. That consciousness, so as parents, how do you impart that consciousness to your children? Behavior is one thing. Devotion for Krishna is another thing. To have a deep sense of dedication of oneself to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Wow, that's parenting. According to the scriptures, you shouldn't become a parent if you can't do that. Because it's the primary duty of the parent to deliver the dependent from birth and death. And deliverance of dependence is not just behaviors, not just please and thank you. It's consciousness. So I'm going to read just a little bit from the purport. It's 4.5 page purport. Just going to read a little section, and I think you'll like it. Prabhupada is speaking in part of the purport about the fructification of previous karma. Prarabdha karma is a term that means karma that's happening now. And then there's karma that's not happening now, it's aprarabdha karma, but it's in different stages. One is it's completely dormant. Another is just starting to sprout and just about to manifest. And there's terms for it. And then it's manifesting. And fruitive workers are just dealing with all of that stuff. Even the stuff that, like, I want $1 million or, you know, whatever it is that they want. I want to conquer the world. I want to climb Mount Everest. I want to do it, whatever it is. Something. That's it from their previous activity. That desire and all of what they do, it's a continuation or it's a reaction of the desire. Is a reaction of our previous material contact and previous activity. So guna and karma. Combination of the two. Then we have a desire. And the desire says, I want, fill in the blank. So fruitive workers are involved with all of that. A little bit elevated is those that follow Vedic codes to get good ones and eliminate the bad ones. When one takes to devotional service, however, all phases of sinful life, including prarabdha, aparabdha, and bija, are vanquished. In the Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna tells Uddhava, gives the verse in Sanskrit, my dear Uddhava, devotional service in relationship with me is like a blazing fire that can burn to ashes all the fuel of sinful activities supplied to it. Devotional service, paradharma. How devotional service vanquishes the reactions of sinful life is explained in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Kapila Dev to Devahuti. Where he says, Devahuti says, my dear Lord, if Even a person born in a family of dog-eaters hears and repeats the chanting of your glories, offers respects to you, and remembers you. He is immediately greater than a brahmana and is therefore eligible to perform sacrifices. Therefore, what is to be said of one who has seen you directly? Paragraph. In the Padma Purana, there's a statement that persons whose hearts are always attached to the devotional service of Lord Vishnu are immediately released from all the reactions of sinful life. These reactions generally exist in four phases. So that was mentioned. Manifest now, about to manifest, just beginning to fructify, and is in the seed dormant state. And time and circumstances help them become prarabdha karma. When devotional service is present in one's heart, desires to perform sinful activities have no place there. Sinful life is due to ignorance, which means forgetfulness of one's constitutional position as an eternal servant of God. When one is fully Krishna conscious, he realizes that he is God's eternal servant. When there's light, there's no darkness. So they have their light on. Darkness can't enter. Last paragraph, and this is really why I wanted to read this particular verse. This section is exquisite. It's speaking of, or reference is made to Jiva Goswami, who comments on this verse. And he comments on it in his Bhakti Sandarbha. He says, Jiva Goswami, I'm a Jiva Goswami fan. Jiva Goswami says, bhakti can be divided into two divisions. One, santata. That means devotional service that continues incessantly with faith and love. Two, kada chitki. Devotional service that does not continue incessantly, but is sometimes awakened. Sometimes not. Intermittent. It's like electricity in India.
Vrindavan.
Not just Vrindavan. Okay, we'll go into it. Of the two, the first one has two divisions and the second one has three divisions. Santata may also be divided into two. Service that is performed with a slight attachment. Attachment for either the process of devotional service or the object of the process of devotional service. Asakti, attachment. Or, the second is, spontaneous devotional service. Even if there's a slight attachment, it's uninterrupted. Or spontaneous, nothing can stop it. Now, the not continuous or intermittent kada chitki has three categories. Raga basamayi. Raga basamayi. One is almost attached. Then it goes down. Raga basa shunya svarupa bhuta. Devotional service in which there is no spontaneous love, but one likes the constitutional position of serving. There's some people like that. They like to serve. Just let them loose. And they'll be doing some service. They like. They may not like their son as much as they like service, but they like service. Or the third is abhas rupa. Abhas, slight glimpse of devotional service. Like, we have three different stages of chanting: beginning, intermediate, and advanced. Offensive, clearing, pure. Nam aparad, nam abhas, shuddhanam. So this abhas is in the intermediate stage. That's in this intermediate, or excuse me, intermittent. Sometimes, sometimes not. Sometimes, sometimes not. As far as atonement, if one has caught even a glimpse, this abhas of devotional service, all needs to undergo prayaschitta atonement are superseded. Therefore, atonement is certainly unnecessary when one has achieved spontaneous love, and above that, attachment with love, which are the signs of increasing advancement in kadachit ki. Even in the stage of abhas rupa bhakti, all the reactions of sinful life are uprooted and vanquished. Srila Jiva Goswami expresses the opinion that the word karchnyena, that was in that verse, kechit kevalya bhaktya vasudeva parayana, agham dhunvanti karchnyena. He says, Jiva Goswami says, that means that even if one has a desire to commit sinful actions, the roots of that desire are vanquished merely by abhas rupa bhakti. So this is the compare and contrast with punishment or atonement or some fine or penalty, undergoing some austerity or doing some pious activity. Tendency for sinful activity isn't taken away. Tendency for getting in contact with matter and squeezing out some kind of juice, sense gratification, tendency isn't taken away. It may be diminished, but it's still there. And we know what happens from Bhagavad Gita, the 14th chapter, with the modes of nature. One may be prominent, but the other two are competing for supremacy. And then, whoop, then one was lower, becomes higher. So someone that's a good person may surprisingly exhibit some anger or some lust or some greed or something, some impurity. Say something harsh. And then gets back to normal again. That's for someone that's a mode of goodness, that's not making the comparison with any one of us. But Jiva Goswami says even this abhas bhakti, even a glimpse of devotional service, that abhas bhakti, can destroy up to the root even the tendency for having such a desire. The potency is there. The abhas feature of bhakti is compared to twilight. What's twilight? Somewhere between day and night. It's not day and it's not night. When Ram was in the forest and having battle with different rakshasas. He was told, advised to kill them before twilight because they get very powerful at twilight. So that Abbas Bhakti is compared to twilight, and the accumulation of one's sinful activities is compared to fog. Since fog does not spread throughout the sky, the sun need do no more than merely manifest its first rays. So there's twilight at night and twilight in the morning also. So sunrise and sunset. The fog immediately disappears. Similarly, if one has even a slight relationship with devotional service, all the fog of a sinful life is immediately vanquished. At least the potency for that is available within bhakti, and not just, well, that's great, that's for people that are really advanced. The Shukadeva Goswamis and the Narada Munis and the great acharyas, and but not me. I'm this little creature, and I've got so much going on with my distracted mind and my impure activities in the past, and oh, too much. But the Bhagavatam says no. The potency is there within. Look at Ajamila. He was really bad. A whole lifetime. 60 years. He was 80 when this whole thing happened, when the Vishnu Dutas, the Amadutas came. Sinful life and stealing and so many things. But all of that was eliminated. So that verse, Keshit Kevalaya Bhaktivasa Deva Prayana Agham Dunvanti Karsneya Niharam Iva Bhaskaram, that verse is the summation of the whole canto. So you just heard the whole sixth canto in a one verse, in a synopsis. Or say it the other way. The other verses are expanding this tadani. They're expanding the message of that one verse. Therefore, conclusion. The Bhagavatam would like us to engage in devotional service to the personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, Krishna. Recognizing that even if we're limited, have so many shortcomings, and all of those things, even a glimpse of devotional service, even bhakti abhas, or chanting, even nam abhas, just a glimpse of chanting, it's so powerful. And what to speak if one regularly takes it up and cultivates that seed of attraction for serving Krishna. Serving Krishna in a purified state of consciousness. Striving for that to be manifest in our life through the medium of devotional practice. The Bhagavatam wants us to do that. It's teaching how to do that, how it works, and how to practically execute it. It's wonderful literature. And I would recommend if you that the topic of duty certainly is a very important one. It's the topic in the Bhagavad Gita, the question that Krishna receives from Arjuna, what is my duty? Or in the Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami hears from Maharaj Pariksit, what is my duty at the time of death? What is it that is now my duty? I know that I'm going to die. What is my duty? and all scriptures. What is one's duty? What should one do? A thoughtful person wants to know, what should I do? What is my duty? So it's a very important topic, and this Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 6 is addressing it in detail, so you could... the feedback, I chose to speak on this particular verse because the feedback from the devotees that attended some number of classes on prescribed duties of mankind, they said they finally got clarity how the whole thing works, why it is so. You might want to listen to those recordings. But the essence of it is here. This one verse. So, any comments or discussion? Yes?
Maharaj, from the discussion, it looks like one's faith in the devotional service or in the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very tiny or little, and maybe the faith is more towards, oh, my problem is so big,
yes,
and it's insurmountable.
And we're looking to our own strength to deal with it, too.
So, given that situation, but still the devotional service as such is supremely powerful, even though I don't have that much faith in that, it should still act. But Is it dependent on me just taking it up and just practicing it, even though I don't have faith in it? How does it?
Even if you don't have faith in it, don't practice it. If somebody around you does, you get benefit. You can be a plant, and you know, somebody around you is doing devotional service. You get benefit. So, what to speak of human form of life if we don't take it up with all seriousness? We're still getting benefit. And it certainly is proportionate to one's submission or faith. But faith increases incrementally and gradually. You start wherever you are and go from there. That the initial faith that's required is preliminary. That's all. There must be something. That much. Beyond all of this, you know, rat race stuff, people running around and doing stuff, there's something more meaningful to life than that. I know there is. So forth. And so with that much faith, then let me hear, let me read Bhagavad Gita, let me, etc., do some of these things. And behind that is some little faith. And it grows. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, we were talking about the sinful tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, my question is, like, tendency is it a deep-rooted attachment to Ganja separately from Krishna?
How did you know?
Otherwise, the faith, like Ramana Prabhu explained, faith will carry me beyond that. So what is my connection to this tendency, like as a soul? I was thinking, like,
it's illusion. That's the connection with that tendency. Or, you know, the particular portion of illusion is envy. That's what Scripture teaches us.
Mm-hmm.
raga dveshas samuthena dvandva mohina bharata. We come here because of that. We struggle. All the struggles are from that struggle. Anything else? Yes.
About the material svabhava and the spiritual svabhava. So as far as the material svabhava is concerned, does it get automatically converted, or is there any point of time when, in our lifetime basically, when the material svabhava gets subdued?
Yes.
When it gets subdued, does it mean that we have our spiritual svabhava has become more prominent?
Yes.
And the material svabhava basically has become spiritual svabhava just because, as Mahaprabhu was mentioning, we don't have any sinful tendency anymore.
Don't have any which tendency?
Sinful
tendency?
Basically, what I'm trying to ask is that like the sugar has the dharma of sugar is being sweet.
Yeah.
So, and it never gets changed unless we do some kind of chemical activity on it. But we always know that, okay, this particle's dharma is sweetness. So as a person, as an individual, basically, I have my own svabhava, basically, either material or spiritual. But does it get, how it gets changed and what is the transition process?
What Lord Kapila Dev describes is the power of devotional service is that it dissolves the subtle elements, including the mind, because the mind is the resting place of impressions, sense impressions. They're stored in the mind. There's where the seeds are. And then after some, through passage of time and circumstance, then those stored impressions come out as desires. So if I no longer have a sinful desire, it's because the material mind is dissolved. Yay! And Kapila Dev says, and there isn't another process that does that. Now, if the material mind is dissolved, then the spiritual mind or is active or activated without any distortion. Because now I may have some degree of desire to be a devotee. But that's covered with so many other desires that are filtering through the material mind. So I can't see clearly. It's all muddy, murky, opaque, distorted. But if I continue, that awakens the tendency to serve, simply to serve, in course of time, the material, what Kapila Dev teaches, is the material mind dissolves. And then the desires for sinful activity with it. Because the desires for sinful activity, going back again, it's just the fructification of previous ones that were stored, previous involvement. We've done all these things already. And then there's the intelligence. Super soul can give intelligence to the conditioned soul how to do sinful activity. How to steal, and so forth. How to create an empire. Just fruit of activity that so many living entities suffer and get hurt as a result, but I want to have an empire. But that's dissolved by the process of bhakti.
Yes, Maharaj. Two things basically. One thing is it is very, very difficult to get away from the innate svabhava of a person basically, and that's why we want to become more spiritual and more
Yeah.
So that's it. Thank you very much.
We can't do it on our own. Want to become more spiritual? Try and try and try. It's not going to happen. I mean, it won't be complete. It'll be unsteady at best. We need descending mercy, and that's where devotional service comes in. That's where the effect of Krishna's involvement in one's life, in one's mind, one's activity, one's heart comes into play. Something else? Children are restless. Yes?
Maharaj, you mentioned spontaneous devotional service.
I'm hearing.
So for somebody in the grihastha stage of life, like me right now, is it possible to...
Yes.
Is it possible? He has to finish his grihastha life.
No. You can finish your grihastha life and still not get there. You can stay in your grihastha life and get there. You want some examples?
Yeah.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Nandan Jasoda.
Kali Yuga, like with so much of attachments.
Okay, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Krishna doesn't say you have to finish your household life and then you can come to me. He doesn't say that. Anything else? Just taking videos. Okay. Yes.
I'm feeling like I'm wanting to progress in devotional service, but I'm feeling like my practices are like kind of.
But you're feeling that you're not what? Practicing that way?
My practices are kind of. I'm not able to practice much. You know, like my practices are reducing.
Your practices are reducing. Bring your head over here. Reducing?
Reducing.
Quantitatively?
Yes,
so do something about it. If you see that that's happening, do something about it. So what's your question?
That's what Maharaj, like, I mean, here we are hearing that devotional service is so powerful, but I'm having this experience in my life, like, I mean, I'm sincerely wanting to progress and all, but...
Well, that's the main component from nectar devotion. The eligibility is sincerity. That's the price to go into the advancement in Krishna consciousness store and get some of the product that they have. You have to have some sincerity. That's the price. If you have sincerity, it's yours. If you look at the bigger picture and, you know, say where you were some few years ago, where you are today, I wouldn't say you've reduced your Krishna consciousness over the last few years. Having said that, there may be some periods where there's unsteadiness, where something is, you know, the sine curve is going up and down. So when the sine curve is going down, it doesn't mean that you've lost your Krishna consciousness, or you're a bad person or a bad devotee or something like that. There may be some period where there's that the unsteadiness is diminishing. Now, when you see that, you put on the brakes, or you hit the reset, or you try to see what's going on. What can I do to strengthen the basics of my Krishna consciousness? It's a back to basics move. And look to the quality of how I'm doing each of the things that I'm doing. And apply effort. Even if it's, you know, it looks like it's still heading in a downward spiral. With sincerity, you keep applying yourself to the basics. And continue to take proper association. The time energy, if that condition is there, the time energy will turn and it'll go, next thing you know, it's back up again. And that's part of the unsteadiness. And then back down again. And you just ride the wave and keep your attention focused on the qualitative way that you're engaging in the basics of Krishna consciousness. Okay. Yes.
In the cracks of my other senses, we generally hear that when we start any spiritual practice, we tend to experience some kind of peace in our heart.
Mm.
But with me, ever since I started my Krishna consciousness, I'm getting more attracted to the process, but I don't experience peace. In fact, I experience more of anxiety in my life. Anxiety to chant, anxiety to read, anxiety to bring my daughter in a particular manner. So, does it happen
with everyone around, or what is it?
Like,
there's no experience of peace as such. People say when you start on your spiritual journey, peace flows with it. Well, two things. She wants you to look at her drawing. Okay. Two things. One is the peace in life is not necessarily that disturbances decrease, but it's how you process those disturbances. So the potential, but it's Sudama and Krishna in the middle of a storm getting wood. They weren't in anxiety. They were in each other's association. They were happy as can be. It was Sandipani Muni that was in anxiety. Oh, these poor boys. Dead of night, looking for wood. The storm comes. So, peace doesn't necessarily mean things aren't going on that are distracting and disturbing, but how you process them. Now, so how you process them is another part. Prabhupada described, this is for one devotee named Karandar, who is a very qualified manager in Los Angeles Temple, and he said to Prabhupada what you just said. Prabhupada, before I came to Krishna consciousness, I was more peaceful. And now I'm, you know, so many things.
There,
yes. Yeah, well, the satisfaction is the essence of the peace. And I don't mean it rhetorically. That is the essence of the peace. So, here's what Prabhupada said: when you go into a room that hasn't been cleaned for years and years and years, and you begin cleaning, what happens? Dust that's been settled and accumulated, it just goes all over the place. And it's a big mess. But continue, and after everything is, the dust is removed and everything is now clean, it's very nice. So, similarly, because of prolonged, who knows how long, material contact we've had, when we're cleansing, things become churned from our heart. And that's what you're experiencing. So the satisfaction is the long-term peace. Just continue with that satisfaction. And as the heart becomes cleansed of impure things, cetta darpa namarjanam, then the other kind of peace, or the mature stage of that satisfaction which you think of as peace. But I say the satisfaction is itself peace. And if you understand what's going on, wow, it's great. Not, oh, this is awful. I can, unto myself and with my dependents and those who I'm serving, I can be a better person. I can give more to them because I like to serve, and so on. You have the longer term and the bigger picture is it's very peaceful. And when you have not just now as a mother and as your daughter grows, it just your whole life, as your whole life unfolds, and other responsibility and more responsibility and things that, you know, might think, oh, this is crushing me. It's a nice opportunity for service. And within that storm, there's the peace. And I'm speaking, you know, from my position of service. There's many things, I deal with many complex things in my position as a GBC and trying to help people and you know, something happens. Something happens in their life and you're part of their life, so it gets complex. But within that, there's the tranquility or peace that Krishna's, this is a wonderful opportunity to serve this sincere person, that something happened and now they're upside down, but let me be in Krishna's service to help them sort all this out. And so within the complexity, there's a tranquility or a satisfaction. That kind of... And if you can keep your mind fixed upon Krishna and the person ultimately who you're serving and the other person who's connected to Krishna, and that's the peaceful position amidst all of this complexity. But take that component out and try to make it peaceful. It's a fool's paradise. She wants something. Okay. Hare Krishna. Anyone else? Okay. So it's prasadam time. Shri the Prabhupada ki jai.